Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. And today I'm welcomed by a wonderful guest, Dr. David Nabarro. Hello, Dr. Nabarro. How are you today?
How do you do? I'm very well, thanks.
Well, thanks for taking the time. This is very exciting. I'm working off a caffeine high, I'll say. I was up late last night dealing with a sick family dog who kept me up. It was a bit of a challenge, but nonetheless, I'm here and very excited to talk to you. It did give me a chance to watch some of the Winter Olympics happening in South Korea, which is I love those stories that we get behind the scenes after, you know, 4 years of training these athletes to come in and they get their one chance. And man, it just puts good emotion behind sport.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Yeah.
So, Dr. Nabarro, I just want to mention a little bit of your introduction of who you are and a little bit about the World Health Organization. So you are obviously a community-based practitioner. You're a medical doctor. You're an international civil servant and a diplomat, an educator. And you've been doing this for 40 years. And in reading your bio, I see that you've had about 20 years working with the World Health Organization, where you've served as a special advisor to the UN's 2030 Agenda for the Sustainable Development and Climate Change Initiative. You were appointed by Secretary General Ban Ki-moon for that position. You've led the UN's response to the cholera epidemic in Haiti, and you've served as a special envoy to Ebola and obviously worked extensively with malaria. So incredible background. You have I had a chance to also read and watch some of your videos of you speaking about some of these initiatives. And I have to say that one thing I was moved by is you have seems to be a wonderful bedside manner in delivering your message to people. And I hope that's taken as a very positive thing.
Yes, well, it's nice of you to say so. And I'm really pleased to be taking part in this podcast because the issues that you're discussing, particularly the links between animal health, human health, and environmental health, things that I've been working on really intensively since I moved into international public health in 1999. And so I'm glad that we're going to be talking about this, especially as I've learned over the years just how important people involved in livestock rearing are for the production of food, but also for the maintenance of the environment and prosperity in rural areas. And so it's a great pleasure to be working with somebody who is explicitly talking with animal husbandry experts.
Well, it is our pleasure. And let's jump into that. And let's talk a bit about your background and the work that you've done with the World Health Organization on food and nutrition and production. So, and again, reading your background and seeing what you've done, you were obviously a UN system senior coordinator for dealing with the bird flu. You've coordinated high-level task forces on global food security. And this is something I'd really like to get into with you is that you've coordinated the movement on Scale Up Nutrition, which was a multi-stakeholder initiative. It was a program that brought together government leaders, civil leaders, the UN, donors, business, and research to tackle some of the biggest problem, which is how do we feed a planet and successfully feed a planet with nutrition involved of 7 billion. So could you share with our listening audience some of your experience within World Health and dealing with nutrition, dealing with proliferating this around the world, and what you see on a future scope for how your involvement will take place in the next 5 years?
Well, thanks. Let's start with the nutrition challenges. Firstly, human beings function best if they have the right amounts of nutrients coming into their body and if they handle those nutrients efficiently. Now, if they've got too little, then unfortunately, they don't do well right from the various earliest days of life, even before they're born. A child that's had insufficient nutrition during gestation, before delivery, and then in the first 2 years of life has long-term consequences that are very hard to rectify. Consequences for their physical capacity, consequences for their mental agility, consequences for their social behavior. And so one of the areas that I and colleagues have been particularly worried about is the reality that in our world today, between 700 million and a billion young children and sometimes also adults are seriously undernourished. They don't grow to the extent they should. Their brains are not developing fully. And sometimes as a result of undernutrition, they're also at very heightened risk of infection and then death as a result of those infections. So undernutrition is a big challenge. Now, I want to stress that actually there's plenty of food in our world at this time to go around to suit everybody. There's enough calories, there's enough nutrients. And so the real challenge is usually that the food is not evenly distributed. One of the underlying causes of undernutrition in today's world is quite simply that people are poor. And it's not just poverty of the kind that we tend to see in the towns and cities where we live. It's actually the extreme poverty that's associated often with either extreme vulnerability and deprivation in communities where there is a lot of poverty, or the poverty that's associated with war and violence that in turn puts people in a situation where they just cannot get the basic food they require. Just at the moment, we're dealing with the impact of four famines in our world in different war zones. And that's led to a rise in the estimate of the numbers of malnourished this year for the first time for many years. And so we have to recognize that severe undernutrition is usually a result of extenuating circumstances like war, like hardship, like extreme poverty. At the other end of this spectrum, we have well over a billion people in our world who are really having unbalanced diets with excess of certain foods, leading to obesity or leading to damage as a result of the wrong diets. Not eating the right fats, i.e. having too many unsaturated fats in the diet, or not eating the right amount of fiber in the diet, or inappropriate quantities of animal protein. And so this excess and unbalanced consumption associated with obesity, associated with actual dietary damage, is an increasing problem, and it's a problem all over the world. One of the marker diseases is type 2 diabetes, thought to be largely influenced by diet, and other problems include high blood pressure and cardiovascular disease. Now, that means that our challenge when it comes to human nutrition is to find the middle path, the path that's associated with the best mental and physical development, the path that is not associated with raised risk of diabetes, cardiovascular, and other diseases, and the path that actually leads to human beings having the best chance of sustainable futures. That's what basic nutrition is all about, and that is determined by a combination of the following. Firstly, people having the right foods to eat in the right quantities at the right time. Secondly, people not experiencing high levels of infectious disease or other challenges during early childhood, particularly. Thirdly, children and young adults having the right care given to them in the home, in the school, and in the community, so that nutrition is given proper attention and there's not skimping of the diet and as a result of things being rushed or things being given insufficient attention. And that's why in the nutrition work I've been doing, we've sought to find ways to bring together the different professions, agriculture and food, as well as health, as well as social welfare, to try to make sure that nutrition is given the attention it deserves as one of the most important requirements for human well-being.
It's quite a paradox when we've got a situation where 1 billion are underfed and undernourished and 1 billion are overfed and extensively unhealthy because of this excessive bounty.
Indeed.
Now, Dr. Nabarro, in looking at that and saying, I've seen the UN estimates, it's become somewhat mainstay in the media around by 2050, we'll have 9.6 billion people.
Yes.
Looking at those projections and also looking at the fact that many of those models that you've been discussing, the both ends of the spectrum, are reliant on detrimental practices in the way that we do connect with our natural environment and especially with regenerative natural resources. Many of our agricultural practices, we have an increased commitment to input-based agriculture. We have a perpetual mining of regenerative natural resources. We overfish the oceans, which directly affects many of the impoverished nations, 3 billion people reliant on sea protein every day for their major caloric intake. And we have waste and overuse of water. So looking at a global population of near 10 billion, is that a realistic number? Can we scale with business as usual? Or do we have to have some kind of a drastic change in the model that we are start to appropriate resources to adding nutrition to within our major mainstays within all every human on planet, and how do we go about getting that knowledge to people, that information to people, and then the food stuff to people?
Well, it's very interesting, Aaron, that all over the world there is an increasing percentage of the population, and it's particularly younger people, who are ready to question whether or not the food systems on which they depend are the right food systems for people and for planet looking ahead 3 or 4 decades. And I think in your introduction, you've summarized it really very well. Firstly, a lot of our food systems in different parts of the world are not delivering the right nutritious foods at an affordable cost for everybody. Secondly, a lot of our food systems are actually using up the natural resources that we have on our planet, whether it is soil or water or even using up the atmosphere in ways that are not fully sustainable. Let's think a bit about what this means in practice. If water is being inefficiently used to irrigate crops and it is emptying aquifers faster than they are being filled, then this is clearly not sustainable. If production systems are leading to a reduction in biodiversity so that we've got a massive and accelerating species extinction rate, that is not sustainable. And if oceans are being fished to the extent that some of the key fish on which populations depend are just disappearing, it is not sustainable. So as well as requiring our food systems to deliver nutritious food in a way that's affordable, there's also a need to ensure that food systems actually regenerate the ecosystems that are so necessary for not just the production of food, but for life throughout the world. And then there's a third requirement. If we look at what is actually contributing to climate change, it's carbon going into the atmosphere. Agriculture has an amazingly important role, both in absorbing carbon from the atmosphere through photosynthesis by plants and trees, as well as catching carbon in soil, and in addition, through contributing to carbon emissions through sometimes high carbon producing farming practices, including livestock rearing, and also rice production in paddies. So a third requirement is that agriculture is smart about climate and actually pays attention to climate. Otherwise, it can be very damaging, both in terms of emitting carbon and failing to absorb carbon. And a fourth requirement for agriculture, and this is really important, is creating employment for people who live in rural areas. And that employment needs to be resilient so that it can cope with the impact of changing climate and weather patterns, but it also needs to absorb the really quite large number of new people who are requiring employment, especially in rural areas. If agriculture does not provide attractive standards of living for young people in rural areas throughout the world, those young people will move to cities or will seek alternative forms of employment that may perhaps be less appropriate and might indeed be verging on the criminal. So what we therefore require is food systems based on agriculture, livestock rearing and fisheries included, that is nutritious, that contributes to the regeneration of ecosystems on our planet, that has a net absorption of carbon rather than release of carbon into the atmosphere, and that contributes to the well-being of people in rural areas. As we look at food systems around the world, yes, I believe that your analysis is right, that in many cases they're not doing the things they should be, and that's why, as I say, more and more people, particularly young people, are saying it's time for change. And do you know who's leading this? It's the farmers themselves. They know that unless farming systems evolve, that there will be long-term consequences that will lead in the end to the possibility that there are shortages of food for the 9 to 10 billion people in our world by 2050. And so, yes, this is a problem that matters for the generations to come. But not so much my own children, but their children and their children's children, i.e. two or three generations ahead, they're going to depend on us finding the right way to adapt our food systems so that they're truly sustainable. And I'm pleased to say that as well as young people starting to talk about it, businesses are increasingly focusing on this. Even businesses that are sometimes criticized for encouraging the practices that we're not so happy about, they're shifting and saying, right, we want to move to sustainable food production systems. We want to move to nutritious food production systems, climate smart food production systems, and food production systems that benefit poorer people in rural areas, the people who we often describe as smallholder farmers.
The power of the engaged consumer and obviously the pragmatist farmer, yes, I couldn't agree with you more. They have a huge role here in looking at this as both a financial potential of the future and a succession plan, as you mentioned. And I think that is a very exciting evolution. And as you have stated, it is, I spend quite a bit of time with next generation folks that are educated or technically savvy, but want to return back to the lands and have quite a bit of interest in being engaged in the future food system and being engaged in these discussions around regenerative natural resource management. And so as you stated in your Director General candidate speech, which for our listening audience, you were one of the finalists this last summer for the Director General position of World Health. You said that one of the initiatives that you had been working on, that you had been directly involved in with penning this project called the Sustainable Development Goals, is it's a plan amongst your 193 member nations for the future of the world's people and planet. And I think yes. That's so well phrased. And you also had mentioned this is the power of partnership, which in your position and what you've done with your background and your lineage and looking towards the scope of the future is very influential and very exciting that you're looking to engage many of these multi-stakeholder initiatives in making better solutions. So could you share with our audience a little more of what these SDGs are and how these 17 goals can shape our future into one that would be stable, both politically, environmentally, and ecologically, and economically?
I need to start by taking you back,
please,
to 2000. In 2000, the wealthier nations of the world for the first time ever, decided that they would focus their development assistance, what's sometimes called development aid, on a small number of really major challenges, particularly in poorer countries. And they developed 8 goals that would guide the use of foreign assistance. They were called the Millennium Development Goals. They started with reducing poverty, then improving child health and maternal health, also improving access to education, water, sanitation, dealing with some major communicable diseases, and also at action for the environment and people's well-being in really difficult areas affected by conflict. Now, these Millennium Development Goals, as they were called, did apply to poor nations. And the experience of having these goals was incredibly successful. It led to real shifts in the well-being of hundreds of millions, indeed billions of people. And so in 2012, as we were reaching the end of the period of the Millennium Development Goals, they were due to run from 2000 to 2015, nations came together in Rio de Janeiro and tried to hammer out what would happen next. What would the new goals and targets look like for the era 2015 to 2030? Well, a number of things happened at that event. Firstly, countries said, well, we don't want to just focus on the poorest nations. We want to focus on the whole world. And they said, we don't want to focus on a few specific areas that are perhaps easy to deal with. We want to focus on all the issues that really matter for the future of humanity and the planet. And they said, we don't want to focus just on what governments should be doing. We want to focus on what everybody should be doing. And they developed this concept of the Sustainable Development Agenda to run from 2015 to 2030, negotiated over 3 years. And what was great was that it was actually agreed by all 193 nations in our world. Their heads came to New York, and it was agreed at a big event in September 2015, and the result is 17 goals, 169, I think it is, targets, and a number of key principles that everybody agreed to for how this will be taken forward. The principles are firstly that this future agenda will be centered on people and nobody will be left behind. Secondly, that it will be universal, applying to rich countries as well as poor countries. So that means no country is spared, and all countries have to be party to the development of the future of our people and planet. Thirdly, that the issues that we're dealing with are interconnected. It's not reasonable to separate out them one from the other, because otherwise that will lead to a failure to appreciate their systemic interconnections. Fourthly, that to tackle them, we need integrated action that cuts across all different parts of government. And fifth, that we need to partner. And that means government works with the private sector, the research community, youth groups, faith organizations, and that means that all together, we are having multiple actors involved, so that the totality of what they achieve is greater than their individual sum. And a key part of this is involving scientists and researchers everywhere, because without them, we won't get the innovation that is necessary. So these principles become the crucible within which the 2030 agenda has been developed. And the 2030 agenda itself, with its 17 goals and its targets, is the only plan we have for the future of the world's people and the planet. And the reason why that's so important is that we don't have a spare planet. So if we go on using up the resources of our planet in slightly outrageous ways, we might end up feeling deeply embarrassed, because we've got a world that is not really suitable for being the host to 10 billion people by 2050, and we will have let down generations to come. It's one of the paradoxes that it's up to us to make certain that the world is suitable for future generations. Now, we've seen real shifts. There's been a fantastic agreement on what has to be done on climate to try to stick to 2 degrees maximum increase in temperature by the year 2030 and beyond. And this was agreed at, in Paris in the month of December 2015. And there's also been a lot of agreement on what needs to be done for humanity in the way of health and in education. But there are other areas, such as how to handle the unfortunately large number of conflicts that are being addressed through violence and warfare. And there's also big challenges on what to do about our oceans, and perhaps most importantly, on what to do with regard to agriculture and food systems. And so those of us who are working on the 2030 agenda are well aware that we've got a huge amount to do for the sake of the future of humanity. And that's why we're seeking at all times to share our passion and our conviction with others. And it's great to find that perhaps as many as 1.5 billion people in our world seem to be aware of the existence of the Sustainable Development Goals in some way or other. A rather smaller number of them are actually active in trying to advance these goals. But for me, that is the biggest challenge for the whole of humanity for the coming 13 years. It's 13 years left till we reach 2030, that we've got to get everybody aware of this plan and everybody participating in the actions that are needed to implement it.
I can speak to what's happening stateside, where obviously our political regime has gone in a completely different direction, but it does not directly reflect where our average civilian is headed. I've seen in many cases where the SDGs have been broadly discussed and implemented as a premise to start to build as a framework for circular and regenerative economies.
Yes.
It's a very exciting evolution that we now have a common language to build around. And that's not just obviously stateside. That is global common language, which, to your credit, in a matter of a few short years, seemed probably almost a virtual impossible task at the time, but has evolved nicely. And I think once we get those early adopters in tow, whether it's going to be from a forced innovator model where we're going to be required to take these steps, or really a proactive approach where people will see the competitive advantage for doing so, it's an exciting movement. So,
but I want to
please.
Stress to you, sorry, yeah. Aaron, it is young people who are at the center of this movement, because they have come to understand the absolute dangers of failing to regenerate the essential resources of our Earth. They're the ones who are active on oceans. They're the ones who realize the seriousness of climate change. And of course, there are political repercussions. Any effort to take a global approach to the future and to try to work for equality between humans, wherever they may live, is bound to attract the frustration of those who have enjoyed having a larger share of wealth and opportunity than others. And they're going to say, what right have you got to tell us that we should be taking less? But if you take a global view, and one that's based on the importance of equity, that sees each human life of equal value, and that respects our Earth, Mother Earth, as being the source of all the good elements that we need for life, then you can start to understand that it just can't be that those who have power take the most and those who have less power are left with the crumbs. And that understanding does mean that we are involved in some quite dense political exchanges about this. And although there will be some world leaders who say, I don't care, we want to just go on taking our large share of everything and leaving others to cope with less and less and less, those leaders will find themselves in a minority, because the majority of people in our world do want a fair world for the future of everybody. And so I when confronted with information about those who are not prepared to stick with the agreements that their predecessors have made, I simply say, well, this you would expect from some, but what matters is that the majority who want a fair world for the future and a sustainable situation for the future need to stick together and advance their cause because they're right. Hmm.
Dr. Nabarro, let's return back to what we started the conversation with, which is with regards to the idea of One Health, where investing in animal wellness can have a direct recourse and positive impact on human health and environmental health. One Health being a term that you've even, I think, coined many years back. So one of the areas that we have been focused on within my private work and also within the Sourcing Matters podcast here is according to the World Health, WHO, 75% of the emerging infectious diseases have spread from humans, from animals. And we're currently in a world where we process 70 billion terrestrial food animals a year and an additional 100 to 150 billion marine animals, both numbers on a drastic rise as cuisine and consumers' interests and taste change. So if we are going to control further health issues associated to infectious disease and to zoonosis and with thwarting political and social and economic unrest, dealing with public health issues, is our best solution to start to evaluate the way that we deal with food animals and looking at it that we need to eat better meat and less of that? That's a bit of a leading question, but I'm going to cue you up to let you talk about that, please, about what the future of food animal production and the way that we shepherd our practices of dealing with food animals can look like in the future, in a responsible and stable future.
Thanks very much. Actually, given your introduction, I'm going to start from a slightly different position and just say humans have been incredibly fortunate. It seems that although there are diseases which jump from animals to humans, and these diseases sometimes are caused by pathogens, that's viruses, bacteria, and parasites, that are particularly virulent, by and large, we manage to avoid large amounts of animal-related disease. We have relatively few scares, and that's because of the incredible immune systems that we have that protect us against a lot of different kinds of potential harm-inducing pathogens. That, unfortunately, means that we can't be complacent. I became involved in this work intensively in 2005 when bird flu was starting to threaten human populations in a very dramatic way, particularly in Southeast Asia. And leaders of nations in Southeast Asia were really worried. They'd had a viral illness called severe acute respiratory syndrome in 2001, 2002, which caused a lot of hardship in Southeast Asia, billions of dollars worth of economic loss. And then along comes bird flu in 2005, threatening to do the same, threatening to be almost as severe or perhaps as severe as the Spanish flu of 1914. And so that led to a real soul searching about what is going on in poultry farming that is making bird flu become a real scary reality. And the answer is that as poultry have become more and more popular as a form of meat among populations, particularly those that are newly wealthy in emerging economies in our world, so the mass production of poultry was on the increase. And some of the mass production was associated with a very low level of biosecurity. And biosecurity means trying to maintain hygiene in animal rearing so that there are not frequent episodes of high levels of infection in these birds that can then possibly be associated with mutations in virus or bacteria that will then lead to harming of humans. And so from about 2005, the real focus was on trying to link together animal health, human health, and the environmental health. And we draw on some work of the Wildlife Conservation Society from some years beforehand, agreed in a thing called the Manhattan Project, which encouraged us to think in terms of a single health discipline that brings together veterinary science, environmental health science, and human health science to cope with the reality that, as you said, 75% of all new infections come from the animal kingdom. It's relevant. You know, HIV/AIDS came from animals. Ebola came from animals. Many other of the viruses and bacteria that we commonly encounter in life, such as Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome and the like, also come from animals. And so what we need to do is to encourage those who work in the different health disciplines that I've just described to actually study and learn to work together, even though the customs that they have in their different disciplines are very varied. And the One Health approach is now much more widely adopted. And one area where it's really important is because we now recognize that there's an increasing likelihood of bacteria in particular becoming resistant to the commonly used antibiotics in our world today. And one of the reasons for that is that we have a very, very much increased level of antibiotic resistance due to heavy use of antibiotics in animals for improving their growth, and also often wastage of antibiotics in industrial production that leads to the development of resistance, and that in turn means that our antibiotics are less useful. So One Health is not only valuable because of the transfer of infection from animals to humans, it's also valuable as a means to deal with antimicrobial resistance and to make certain that the antibiotics we do have can be used for the longer term.
Yeah, the AMR resistance obviously is a situation I think is becoming a little more common vernacular. People are becoming much more aware of this. What we've seen in the States alone, we've got 2 million cases of AMR annually. It's costing the healthcare system about $23 billion and over 25,000 lives. And it's tragic
yeah. because these are often people dying as a result of infections that should be easily treatable.
Right. And what we've at least seen, and we're maybe learning here in the States from other parts of the world, which have been much more adoptive of better practice or looked at things differently or looking at the One Health as a solution, is some of these practices are us in our food animal production models, where 80% of antibiotic utilization in this country take place on farm. That's 30 million pounds a year of antibiotics that are often being fed to food animals, especially large food animals and fowl, as a prophylactic approach for stocking densities and for feed efficiencies. So we're effectively putting public and human health at risk for the production of cheap meat. And that's
now, hang on just a second.
Please.
On that.
Yeah.
If I was a farmer and I knew that regular feeding of antibiotics to my cattle or to my pigs or to my chickens would lead them to grow with 30% or 40% extra meat by the time they went to slaughter, and that this could be achieved for a relatively low expense, I think I'd do that. I mean, it makes absolutely excellent economic sense to do so. And it's only really quite recently that the contribution of antibiotics in foodstuffs to antimicrobial resistance became clear. So I'm super careful in my own work not to imply any blame to the farmers. And more I find farmers are telling me, either through their organizations or even when I meet them individually, that they want to be part of the move towards antibiotic-free feeds. What they don't want is there to be an unfair situation where some farmers can perhaps be a bit unscrupulous and get away with it, and other farmers who are scrupulous end up with lower profit margins because not every society gives a premium for antibiotic-free meat. So just to say that actually this is a newish discovery, and what I am finding is that when they hear about this and understand it, not only farmers but also their consumers, the people who buy meat, are really keen to see the shift. And it's something that's happening as we speak. Back to you.
No, that's excellent insight, and I'm very happy to hear you say that. That
yes.
we align very much in that the consumer can be the driving force here, and no blame should be put on farmers. It's an opportunity within supply chains to get out of a single based of where we don't have value associated within our much of our supply chain. It's all based off of price, where if we had a bimodal supply chain, which really serviced the needs of the consumer's interests, which
yes.
can be around soil health, can be environmental impact, can be the treatment of these sentient animals, it can be what the effect of a bioaccumulator is on your health. All of these
Absolutely.
Things, which all fall within the realm of One Health, and actually porting that information out with transparency and traceability to the consumer is really exciting, where we're now moving towards a future food system. And
we're also finding that the enlightened consumer of today becomes the mainstream consumer of 5 years' time. And so I'm quite comfortable that there is a gradual shift happening. Also, as I study what's happening, what's occurring in Africa, with a gradual intensification of livestock production, because increasing numbers of people are able to purchase meat and wanting to purchase meat, that I'm seeing a real willingness on the part of the livestock producers to embrace sustainable production systems and to be careful about antibiotic use, because they know it matters for the future. So I'm thankful to those consumers in advanced nations who have shown the way. As I say, they are going to become the mainstream trend of only 5 years' time.
Agreed. And I think what's exciting is when we start looking at other food categories like coffee or beer or
yes.
wine or sweets or
sustainable
savories.
Sourcing.
That's
sustainable
right.
sourcing is going to become the norm rather than the purview of an enlightened few. And that's fine. That's how things change in our world. And it's like that.
That's right.
And the more young people in particular realize that sustainable sourcing is good for them, good for the planet, good for the farmers, good for the animals, frankly, because this is important as well, the more they're going to ask for it and they're going to insist on it when they receive meat, either in a restaurant or in a canteen, but also when they buy it.
Dr. Nabarro, where can some of our listeners learn more about the projects that you'll be working on over the next year?
So first of all, I do believe the One Health movement is one of the most important movements when it comes to ways to get sustainable and healthy livestock rearing and the production of livestock products such as meat and such as milk, and also of course skin and so on. And so do keep an eye on that. And there, the Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO, it's part of the UN based in Rome, together with the World Health Organization, part of the UN based in Geneva, and the World Organization for Animal Health, which is the World Association of Veterinary Practitioners based in Paris. These are an important triad of organizations, and together with the Wildlife Conservation Society in the US, and many, many groups like the Texas A&M University, for example, who are working on the One Health approach, are very important. And within the US, I would encourage you to go to the US National Academies of Sciences website, where the National Academy of Medicine is doing a lot of very good work on One Health, led by a number of great American scientists and practitioners who can be helpful. In addition, I'm very excited to see some partnerships involving governments, businesses, civil society, and scientists that really do want to see sustainable food systems emerging, including the One Health base. And one of them is called the Food and Land Use Coalition, or FOLU for short. I'd be very happy to work with you to enable people to find out more about these. I'm wary of offering my email address just in case it leads to a flood. But do not hesitate, Aaron, to, if you get inquiries on your web address, to pass people on to me. Because for me, this is the secret of the future, is providing folk everywhere with the information they need to make healthy and sustainable choices when it comes to food.
I will absolutely do so. I will keep an eye and ear out for any really engaged parties, and I'll be happy to act as a facilitator to moving that forward. Dr. Barrow, I can't thank you enough for joining us on today's conversation. You've enlightened our audience and myself on a great deal of information. It really is a wonderful opportunity for us to learn from someone with your experience. And so as I go home and get to deal with my sick dog, which she may need antibiotics, and that's okay, because
that's
when
okay.
someone is sick, it's just okay. like our kids and our dogs, that's right.
She should take the full course.
That's right.
She should not be given antibiotics without there being proper veterinary justification. And you should, along with everybody else, do practice good hygiene with your domestic pets, especially when they're ill. This also is important. But yes, and you know, animals are part of our lives.
They are.
They're part of our livelihoods. They're part of our destiny. And the whole area of ensuring good health of our animals, good health of ourselves, good health of our environments is part of respecting animals for who they are and what they are for all of us. So best wishes to you with your own dog, but also best wishes to all listeners with their pets, with their livestock, and with the wild animals that they love, because this is how we will have a sustainable future.
Wonderful. And see, there's that wonderful bedside manner once again. So thank you, sir. Thank you. I really appreciate you taking the time. Take care.
Good, good. Bye-bye, and thanks.